Hello, and welcome to another episode of Shipping and Handling. I'm your host, Jennifer Udden.
And I'm your co-host, Bridget Smith.
We are on a roll, I have to say, with the production and timely distribution of episodes.
We're doing real well.
I feel like we should self-high-five ourselves, just like, yeah!
And we've also been keeping track of some of our listenership numbers,
because yes.
You know how we always talk about our dozens of listeners.
But it turns out we have many, many more than dozen. We have hundreds of listeners. According to our Libsyn stats, we have had 650 downloads in February. So thank you.
Today is February 20th.
And today is February 20th. So that's
21st.
21st?
Dates are hard.
Dates are hard. Time? What? I don't know. So
we're very, very grateful that you all keep coming back and listening. We're just so happy you like us.
Well, it's nice to know that, you know, even if we don't always get, you know, a ton of questions or a ton of reviews, it's nice knowing that someone is out there listening. And
yes, it's not just us talking to ourselves.
Which we do all the time anyway.
We do that a lot.
Well, speaking of sort of, you know, regularity and, you know, establishing a pattern.
Yes.
One of the things that I think we wanted to talk about today, and that comes up a lot of questions that we get from sort of like conferences and stuff, is how do you have time to do everything? And the answer is we don't.
We really don't. I've been struggling with this lately because for a long time my strategy of how to get through manuscripts was to spend the entire weekend reading them, because I don't have time during the day at work to read manuscripts very often. Mm-hmm. And so I try to do those on weekends so I can get through them. And so I'd spend, you know, 6 hours in a coffee shop on Saturday and Sunday reading manuscripts. But anytime I do things that are fun on weekends instead of spending the whole day working, all of a sudden I get way behind on my reading, and it's really terrible. And so, it's not just me that's overwhelmed. That's unfair to the people who have sent me their manuscripts and are waiting for a response. It's unfair for me to just sit on them for months. Because I'm off doing fun things on the weekend.
Well, you know, just for people who may, you know, not be familiar with, you know, the other things we do during the day, what kind of things are you doing during the day? Because I think that there's this sort of very romanticized, like, just sit around and read. I'm like, if that were only true.
No. Well, in addition to submitting manuscripts to agents and to editors and trying to sell them, and there's all the things that come after that. There's contract negotiation and then dealing with sub rights. But there's also, my agency is just me and my boss, and so I do a lot of the day-to-day running of the agency, whether it's processing the mail, doing the filing, writing checks for our clients, going through royalty statements, handling permissions that for reprint requests. It's a lot of it does change every day, which is nice, but it's just a lot of stuff.
It's a lot. I mean, I have much less on my plate than you do, because I think we're a larger agency, so my duties are
your duties are more evenly distributed.
Yeah, but still, I mean, I'm in charge of a lot of like the mailing and shipping. It's funny, I was joking to my mom the last time I was home that, you know, in my first job when I graduated from college, it was basically all mail merge all the time.
Oh,
and
God.
I feel like my job now is just a different, you know, more media mail centric version of that.
Media mail is a wonderful thing.
Oh, God bless the U.S. Postal Service. Although, because of all the snow, they've been so backed up that one of our agents has been waiting for some books for a really long time, just because, dear, you know, we schedule a pickup and then they're not able to come, or there's, you know.
Or they can't get it to them on that side.
Yeah, and I also read all of my boss's queries, and I read a lot of his.
Yes,
And he does a lot of conferences, a lot of writers' workshops and stuff, and so I have a lot of reading from that as well. So it's not just me that I'm reading for.
Oh, yeah.
So I honestly, like, I'm the same way where I'm like, oh, I'm going to take this weekend, and I'm just going to read.
Get through 5 manuscripts. It's going to be great.
Now,
this never happens.
And so, and I guess the question also is, you know, because we also try to stay abreast.
Yes.
Sorry. I'm very tired. Because we also try to stay on top of sort of like current trends and stuff in reading, you know, when do you do your sort of reading for pleasure?
Usually when I go to bed at night. I generally try to read about, I don't remember who this was. Someone tweeted something. It may actually have been Joe Hill. About how someone once said to him that the number of pages you read each day actually works out to be the number of books you read each year. And I don't know how that happens. Like, I don't know the math on that. I don't see how it works, but I generally try to read about 50 pages a day, and I wind up reading about 50 books a year.
Oh my God, that's amazing.
I don't know.
Oh, that's so fascinating. I'm gonna have to track that. I don't. That's one of the things on Goodreads that I don't do. I don't update like the page by page.
Oh no, I don't do that either. I just do the like every time I.
But it would be fascinating to track that and see like how that actually.
I saw that on Twitter. I was like, that can't possibly be true. And then I thought about it. I was like, oh my God.
Yeah. Wow. Damn. Okay. I'm going to have to think about that. But yeah, I don't usually read right before I go to bed. If I read right before I go to bed, I read nonfiction. I can't like get caught up in a plot right before I go to bed, because then I either stay up way too late reading and finishing, or I just, you know, get very, I'm like thinking about it, you know.
Yeah. My problem is generally that I get too sleepy, and then I feel like I'm not getting as immersed in the books as I would really like to.
Yeah.
That's also why I don't read manuscripts before I go to bed.
Yeah,
I can't read them in a way that is actually beneficial to anyone.
Yeah, it's tough, and especially with manuscripts, you know, you want to give them, and I don't know if this is true for you, but I certainly feel like, you know, I want to give them, you know, the best reading experience.
Mm-hmm.
So often if I'm like very busy or very stressed, like I'll put off reading manuscripts because I don't want to read something when I'm in like a pissy mood and then get mad at the book. It's not the book's fault that I'm, you know, having a terrible day.
Yeah.
But I don't know if that's something that
I generally do try to do that, just because since I know I'm going to wind up rejecting most of the books that I read anyway, I want to at least know that I'm giving them a fair shot.
Yeah.
If it didn't work for me, it's not my fault. It's just, or it's not because I was in the bad mood or I was hungry. Hadn't had enough coffee that day.
The struggle is real. The struggle is real.
This is why I go read in coffee shops. I can get regular supplies of caffeine and snacks.
Yeah, it's funny. I've started taking, especially when I need to, because I've also, now that I've got a fair number of clients now. I have 13 clients. And when I have to do editing, I've found that I can't really edit at work because there's always people coming in and out. You can't see our recording space right now, but we're in my office, and it's actually the library for the Moss Agency. So it's basically a communal room that I work in. So I don't really get a lot of privacy, which is fine. But it means that if there's any kind of like intense concentration work that I have to do, I have to do it at home. Thank God there's a coffee shop by my house that does not have Wi-Fi.
Oh.
Because that's the other thing for me is with you know, the internet and with social media, I am so easily distracted. And it's also very easy to convince myself that it is sort of work related.
Yes.
I don't know if you sort of fall into that. Like, but this Twitter is important.
I can spend the whole day looking at MSWL because I favorite things that editors say they want.
Exactly. And it's, so we're also recording this sober today because Bridget gave up wine for Lent.
Yep.
So,
Jen's got a Diet Coke and we've got some water and we're,
Yeah. We're just like, oh, this is hard. I gave up social media, so if you haven't seen me tweeting, that's why. I'll probably tweet to promote this episode, but
So it's, the internet is a really terrible distraction, even when it's useful.
The internet giveth and then it taketh away.
Is this part of why you've given up social media for
Yes, lunch? That is part of it. Well, you know, they said that you should give up something that's like an actual sacrifice.
Yeah.
And I'm going to Prague in 2 weeks, so there was stuff that I was just not going to give up.
Too much sacrifice.
But I mean, but I've noticed the last couple of days, you know, I have, you know, the human brain, you know, needs distraction. It needs, it can't really do the same thing for like a long time. So I'll find myself, you know, every 30, 45 minutes going, okay, I need to take a break. And then I'll sort of go to my internet browser and be like, well, I was going to check my Facebook or read that blog, but I can't. And I found that it's really forced me to find, you know, different ways of
refreshing yourself.
Of refreshing my brain. And I honestly haven't, I mean, it's only 4 days in, so like, we'll see how I feel after 40 days. But, you know, it's honestly made me sort of think about, you know, how I'm spending my time. One of the things that I've been doing this week is I got an iPad for Christmas, and I'm using this reading app, and it links to my Dropbox. So what I've been doing is I've been toggling back and forth with a client sent me a new draft.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll read that for like 30 or 40 pages, and then I'll switch to like a manuscript. And then I'll check email. And so because those are three sort of moderately productive things, so, I don't feel so bad toggling back and forth between them every, like, you know, 20 minutes or whatever.
So do you read multiple manuscripts at the same time?
Meaning, do I read multiple manuscripts under consideration at the same time, or?
Yeah, just, or you said you were switching from a client's manuscript.
Yeah, I'll do that. I mean, and especially, especially since it's a project that I've already taken a look at, this is like a second draft, so I'm already pretty familiar with it. I'm reading for like the new stuff. I'm trying to see if the rhythm of the new draft works. If it was like the first draft, I wouldn't read something else at the same time, just because that would be.
I was going to say, I can't do that.
No.
I can't keep it straight.
Me neither.
I have to write down notes. If I read multiple manuscripts over the weekend or something, I have to consult my notes in order to remember what I thought about each one.
And I also, I will usually draft the, you know, whatever, if it's a requested manuscript and I'm passing on it, I'll usually draft that the minute I finish reading.
Yeah.
So that, or at least, you know, write it out, you know, even if it's longhand, I'm in a coffee shop, just because if I leave it, I forget.
Yes.
I'm like,
I had thoughts.
Yeah. And I didn't, and someone was, our friend Connor Goldsmith was making fun of me the other day because I write really long emails sometimes when I'm passing on something, especially if it's something that I was really on the fence about.
Yeah.
Because even if I'm not the right agent for it, you know, I still want it to be a good book.
Yes.
In whatever home it finds. So I end up, you know, writing fairly.
And I hope that sometimes that my feedback might lead them to find a better agent. But also, if the feedback is not resonating with you, then that's fine.
Then that's...
It just confirms that I was not the right agent.
Exactly,
for you. Yeah. Well, so I am... Because the... The weekend thing. Well, this weekend I'm trying to get a lot done, just so I can sort of get on top of things.
I feel like I'm never on top of things, though.
No.
Like, I am Sisyphus. Yes. The rock is my query pile.
Yes.
And the mountain is just never ending. There is no top of the mountain. It's just I'm hauling shit up a mountain.
I feel like right now the rock is chasing me back down the mountain, so I'd at least like to get in front of it and start pushing it back up.
Yeah.
This weekend we're recording. I'm going to a party tonight, and then but like in between now and then, I'm going to be reading, and then tomorrow I'm going to be reading.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm hoping that I will have a concrete amount done on Sunday night that I can be proud of.
Yeah.
But I'm also trying to make sure I spend some time during the week, reading, usually weeknights, but, not just saying, oh, I have some time right now.
Can you read manuscripts on your commute?
Sometimes, I've read good ones on my commute. I've read ones that I was able to tell very quickly were not for me, and I could pinpoint exactly why. But I do find that often I sort of just it exists in that weird nebulous space.
Yeah.
And if I'm my commute is often very crowded, so if I'm like standing and holding a pole and next to someone, that's a bad environment for reading. I don't want to subject the manuscripts to my cranky commute face.
I do a lot of my sort of like outside of school reading on the on the train, because I find that it's a little easier. But I think that this feeds in a lot to you know, thinking about, you know, what do we have time for? What do we prioritize during the day? What do we try to do on the weekends? I think it is interesting in terms of like the world of writing advice.
Yes.
Because as I was saying earlier before we started, you know, there's a lot of advice that says, you know, write every day, and like write, you know, in the mornings before you go to work, or, you know, write like the first thing you do when you come home, or write on your lunch break.
Yeah.
And, you know, I feel like that's really hard to manage for a lot of people.
Yeah.
Like, it's so much easier said than done.
Yeah.
Like, for me, when I get up in the morning, I'm like, fuck, I want to stay in bed. Like, I don't want to write.
Everything is terrible.
And I don't feel like, you know, and I feel like there's a certain amount of, I mean, it's good advice, but I feel like in some situations, it's almost like shaming.
Yeah.
Like, you obviously don't want to write enough because you're not, like, waking up at 6 in the morning to write every day.
Yeah. I don't know if you also share this experience, Jen, but the more guilty I feel about how long I've put something off, the more I put it off.
Yes! Oh my God!
If I feel guilty because hypothetically, if I were a writer, if I felt guilty because I hadn't written in a week, I'd just wouldn't, I'd feel more and more ashamed, and I wouldn't want to open that file.
Yeah, because it's sort of, I mean, it's hard because I feel like there's this really interesting, we're in this really interesting moment where, you know, a lot of sort of creative pursuits are also mixed up in this culture of, like, relentless self-improvement.
Yes.
I don't know if that, you know, makes a whole lot of sense, but, you know, I'm going to write and, you know, the writing will, you know, help me attain my, like, best self. And, like, it's like, I just feel like there's this sort of weird synergy between those two things that sometimes gets to be a little much.
And it's, I feel like the word count sharing is sort of a double-edged sword on that too.
Oh my god, and I...
Sometimes you feel really good and it's like, this is helping me and I'm achieving things and I can put that gold sticker on my calendar to show that I wrote 1,000 words today. Credit to Victoria Schwab for the calendar star system, which I actually use for reading.
Oh, really?
Yes. It's very useful. I can look at it and go, oh, that was a really unproductive week. Or, oh, look how much I did this week. That was great.
I'm gonna give myself some gold stars. Good Lord.
But so if you, sometimes it really helps, but then sometimes it starts to weigh on you.
Yeah.
And it's not necessarily that you should only write when it feels good to write, but also if you have to take a break, that's totally fine.
Yeah.
It's not, it's really okay. You need to process how this, sometimes it's just needing to process how the story works.
Yeah.
Sometimes you need to write things out to figure them out. Sometimes you need to just let them sit for a little while and let your brain sort of percolate.
And I feel like, you know, whatever happens, you know, whatever method you follow, as long as you end up with a finished book, you know, if it works, it works.
Yeah.
So.
Fine. You just got to try different things and figure it out and see what works for you personally. And I also feel like sometimes people who are struggling just look for what works for everyone else, and that's fine as long as you are trying it and seeing whether it can work for you.
Yeah, it's also, I mean, this sort of goes back a little bit to my point earlier, is like when I'm struggling and I sort of, you know, if I look up, someone once introduced me to the blog Lifehacker, which is like, it's just the worst. It's just the absolute worst. Like the biggest time wasty nonsense.
Yeah.
You know, because you're like, oh, well, this is such a great time saving. Meanwhile, I've wasted like 30 minutes on this fucking website, like reading productivity tips. But yeah, I think that people think, you know, as agents that we sort of, you know, live this like very glamorous life of sort of like, you know, sort of measured accomplishment, but like in reality, you know, we're sort of like hustling to and from work and you know, going to our events and trying to have a life on the weekends.
Yes.
And god, I mean, I think about, you know, people I know who are agents and are like married with children. I'm like, how?
I was thinking that
they're
today.
So superhuman. Props to anyone in this industry who tries to, I mean, because like the average person who is married with kids and, you know, works, you know, has enough trouble reading because of, you know, all the demands
all
on their time. And when that is your job and you have, because editors have the exact same problem as we do, where there's all sorts of other stuff that they have to do during the day that is not read.
Yeah. Not read, not edit. So they wind up having to do all of that on their free time as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I don't understand how, especially if you have little kids, like if you have teenagers, you can kind of like send them off and do their own thing. But if you've got like a 4-year-old.
Yeah.
How? I'm just blown away.
Yeah. Oh, man. It's hard out there.
Yeah.
It's hard out there. Well, let me. So what is your advertised response time on the website?
For queries, 4 weeks. And then when we receive requested manuscripts, I generally say 6 to 8 weeks, which is a bit of an exaggeration. I always hope that I can get back down to there. Sometimes I get down to 8 weeks and I'm like, yes, I'm doing it. Right now I'm not at 8 weeks.
I would say that for queries, I'm pretty good. My response time for requests is just, I mean, it's like shameful, but yeah. It's just really bad. There are more guidelines than rules.
Yes.
But yeah, in 2015, I aim to
get back on
that. Mm. This just ended on a really down note.
Yeah. I feel completely overwhelmed now. No, I'm going to go home and cry.
Oh my god, I'm not reading today. I'm going to the gym because I'm just so tired and I've
decided that this week and possibly next week, I'm just going to skip the gym so I can read.
Well, I'd realize that I have much more energy when I go.
Yeah.
So I feel like
Yeah.
Also, I'm also going to Prague, and I don't want to, like, have my legs fall off on the second day because I'm, like, you know, schlepping all over. Well, we do have some questions. Do we want to check Twitter to see if anything...
Well, this is actually a relevant question from Twitter from Tracy Townsend, who's my client, at The Storymatic. She said, all jobs have parts that make you question carrying on and parts that convince you to. Yours as agents. Well... The part that makes me question carrying on is how much reading I have to do and how far behind I get, and the occasional sense that it's just never-ending and overwhelming, and I'm spending all of this time doing unpaid work.
Yeah.
But then sign clients, and you get to sell their books, and especially selling a first book for an author. It's just so satisfying and exciting, and it makes me proud to have any sort of hand in their career.
Yeah, that's definitely a plus. I mean, for me, the thing that sort of is always a little bit discouraging is, you know, we live somewhat publicly as agents, and sometimes the feedback, there are so many avenues for people to tell you that they hate you.
Yes.
And sometimes it's hard to avoid those avenues. Like your inbox, you know, there's sort of like, you know, the sort of classic response is someone replying to a pass by saying, fuck you, which happens all the time.
Yeah.
And then there's this sort of like, oh, you don't know what you're talking about. I'm like, but I do know what I'm talking about. Why did you query me if you didn't think that I know what I'm talking about? I think that's the thing that sort of, because I love my job, and I love reading, and I love I love being someone's partner in their sort of creative endeavors, and the part that just is just hard to get excited for in the morning is knowing that there's going to be like tweets saying that I'm just like fucking awful, or like Query Tracker. Like, I looked at Query Tracker once, and then I looked the fuck away. I was like, I'm never going back, because it was just like everyone telling me what a bitch I was.
Oh god,
it was just like, I'm just like, sorry that I have like a job that I have to do, and I can't respond to your query within like 5 seconds. But I mean, the part that sort of like, you know, it keeps me going is just getting to partner with people and getting that magical experience of reading something for the first time that you just know is going to be special.
Yes.
Like for me, my story that I tell all the time is reading Marika Nykamp's This Is Where It Ends. I was reading it. It was one of the few manuscripts I've ever read on the subway. I was reading it at the gym when I was like on the treadmill, like on my Kindle, sort of paging through. And then I was on my way home, and I was just crying. I was just crying so hard. And I wasn't even done with the book. I think I still had like 15% left in the manuscript. And I emailed her like the second I got home.
Oh, wow.
Because I was like, if anything catastrophic happens in the last 15%, the rest of it is so amazing.
It's like, we can fix that.
We can fix that. And, you know, that experience of just reading it and knowing that it's just like, that it's going to be so special. And, you know, now we sold it to Sourcebooks, and it's got this amazing cover that someday I'll be able to share with everyone. And
she,
like,
shared it with me. It's really amazing.
It's amazing. You know, but
completely unbiased. It's an amazing cover.
Or like Emma Newman's Planet Fall, which is just, I mean, I remember when she pitched that book to me, like back in our first conversation, she's like, it's about this cool thing that I can't talk about in space. And I was like, yeah, it was just amazing. And I, you know, the satisfaction of knowing that I helped.
Yes. Yeah, that was, among other things, all of my clients write amazing books, obviously. But one that was really exciting for me was Emma Mills's, which is now titled First and Then and coming out this fall. And I read it in one sitting while I was on vacation. And then I looked at her videos and was like, oh my God, she's
You're amazing.
Delightful. I need to work with you. How have you not had an offer yet? And so then we did some revisions, but I was sitting there. I was like, this is going to be the first book I sell. This is going to be the first book I sell. And it was, and very, very quickly as well. So I was just, and I'm so thrilled that I've been able to work with her. I'm so proud of this book, even though I had very little hand in it.
I always feel like it's the last song from Working the musical, where it's like, see that building. Everyone. I think the other thing that I really love about this industry, and maybe it's just because I'm party cat to the max, like, because I love people. I get to meet so many great people.
Oh my god, yes.
And, you know, all the events and the book launches and the parties, and like, I just love that, just meeting people who are as excited about this nerdy nerdy nonsense.
It's I've said this before, maybe not on the podcast, but it's networking. Our job, we have to do a lot of networking, but networking is basically just talking to people about books that we both love.
I know.
It's the best thing in the world.
I'm always just like, I mean, what party was it? Oh, I think it was, I got to go to, through a friend of ours, I got to go to the launch party for the movie of the Cassandra Clare novels.
Oh.
And it was just this, I mean, it was this completely bonkers party, and it was just amazing. And there were so many people there. I met a bookseller from St. Louis who was there and who was excited about it. I met like a blogger who was like 17, and like, nice. it was just like a really cool confluence of people. Yeah. And I just remember looking around going like, this, my job is so awesome.
And it's almost everyone that I meet in publishing is exactly the kind of person that I sort of collected as a teenager, the people that I wanted to spend time with and wanted to hang out with. We're all huge nerds, and we just really love talking about books. And so these are the people that I was friends with in high school, and there weren't very many of them. So we all sort of clung to each other. And now I work in an industry where that's everyone. It's amazing.
And it's always funny when you go to a party and there's clearly some people who haven't gotten the memo, and you're like, dude, it's fun here. Calm down. Well, that was a good question from Tracy. We got another question from a gentleman via email, asking about short stories and if those are
worthwhile
for authors to pursue before they query a novel. And you had some thoughts on this.
It's sort of a mixed bag.
Yes and no, I think, is the answer.
The truth is that sometimes, especially in SFF, short stories make for very useful credentials. If I see certain markets in a query letter, I will be much more interested in reading the novel. But also, you don't need to. Like, my client Tracy hasn't sold any short stories, but her fantasy novel is awesome, and so I signed it. But it's also, short stories and novels are, it's sort of like sprinters and marathoners.
Mm-hmm.
Some people are really good at both. Many people are not. Some people, your brain just can't conceive of a story that fits into a short story. And some people are very good at short stories, but can't build novels. And they're they're different skills. Practicing by writing short stories can improve your sentence by sentence craft, but it's a different sort of storytelling mechanism. And so if you want to work on short stories, if you find that it's fun for you and it's satisfying for you, sometimes also writing a whole bunch of short stories can be like, I made a thing. Look how exciting, I made a thing. And so if it gets you excited about writing in general, then absolutely.
Yeah.
But if you find that you just can't write in the short story form, that's totally fine.
I feel like, if you're approaching it from the point of view of, I need to write a short story so that I can sell my novel, then that's not quite the spirit to sort of enter into it. I personally don't read a lot of short stories. I know many people who are who really have their finger on the pulse of a lot of really exciting short story work or novella work. Like Tor.com is really doing amazing things right now. But that has never been something that I've gravitated towards, and so I have not, explored those avenues in terms of like finding clients. But there are people who do that, who sort of comb through the quarterlies, and especially in like literary fiction, there's all these like weird random places that I'm like, that sounds really fancy, and I have no idea what you're talking about.
I do think that the SFF short market is the most robust.
Combination
of CIFWA and the short fiction awards, like the Nebulas, which the nominees for the Nebulas were just announced yesterday. Very exciting batch. The Nebulas and the Hugos, and the fact that CIFWA has designated pro rates for counting for what constitutes a professional market, and how much you have to make per word in order for it to count, and then the magazines that really strive to pay that so that they can be CIFWA qualifying markets. The fact that this it's a small market, but it is more robust than pretty much anything else.
Yeah, I get the feeling that and you know, I don't really have a whole lot of insight into this world, but I get the feeling that in the sort of literary fiction world, you're doing it for the prestige.
Yes.
And you're not necessarily doing it for the money.
And there are a handful of really big fancy places like the New Yorker and the Atlantic and Tin House and these.
The Atlantic does short fiction?
Yeah.
Oh,
I believe so.
Fancy. I don't know. I really just read Tennessee Coates on The Atlantic and that's sort of it.
But they also only do like, they do a very small number.
Mm-hmm. And it's like James Salter.
Yes. It's very well known people. And so it's incredibly difficult to establish any sort of track record there or any sort of credentials. They're just probably not going to buy unknown writers.
Yeah.
And so no matter how good it is. So it's a lot harder to establish anything there than in, and there's like no short mystery market or anything like that.
Yeah, not anymore. I mean, I feel like that was probably a thing back in the days of like Ellery Queen magazine, but yeah. I don't think it's a thing anymore.
Children's is just like not a thing. It's, you can write for highlights maybe, but that doesn't necessarily. Yeah.
I feel like, you know, where it's important in a query is if, you know, if you feel like it's work you're proud of and you really want to bring attention to it, or if it's in, you know, a big enough venue, like if you had a tour.com novella published, like, an SFF agent like wants to know that because
especially because tour.com buys very little out of the slush pile. So if you are at a level where you're querying agents, then if you've been published by tour.com, definitely let us know.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I hope that answers that question. I think we have one more from Colton.
From Colton?
So Colton has a sort of lot of questions rolled into one, and we're going to sort of try and take them one at a time, because I think they're all really good questions and deserve
lots of
attention.
Thought and attention.
So the first one that he says is, what makes a story unsellable? Because unpublished authors are often advised to write the story they want to read or one that only they could write. What makes a story unsellable? There's no one thing.
Yeah.
One of the big things that we talk a lot about is dystopian fiction.
Yes. If you're writing in a trend that's over.
Yes.
That will make it very difficult to sell.
Yeah.
You don't have to be writing the current trend, but you shouldn't be writing the last trend.
Yeah. You know, the things that will date your book, or that you can look around in the bookstores and see that there's already a lot of that thing.
Yeah.
That means that when you go to publishers, they're going to...
It's going to have to support the weight of all of those.
It's going to have to support the weight of all of those. You know, and the only other thing that really comes to mind is, like, you know, straight up unsellable is if... You know, the writing doesn't always have to be, like, top-notch for something to really catch on and to sort of, like, find a home.
Mm-hmm.
But there has to be something in, like, the characters or the setting or the plot that really gets people's attention.
Yeah.
And I think that a book that sort of lacks that is not necessarily going to find a home.
Yeah,
it's got to have, like, one... It's got to have two of the three.
Yes. And it's got to be... If it's lacking... The more it's lacking, the more vibrant the one thing that it has to be.
Yeah.
So, like, I didn't particularly enjoy Twilight. I actually found it tremendously boring when I read it in college. And could barely... I only got through it because one of my friends was like, you'll really enjoy this book. It's really great. And she really latched on to the romance. She found it just like... She actually found that there was a lot... going on in the story, and she wanted to find out what was happening next.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't care at all, but a lot of people did, and so that's what hit so big, is that there was something that people were able to grab
it was able to tap into sort of an emotional vein that people really, I mean, for me, talking about, you know, things that really caught on, like The Martian, which was originally self-published, it was by Andy Weir, and I think Crown published it. You know, there's a lot there that sort of just wasn't all that compelling. Like, he has no emotional insight into this whole process at all. But it was fascinating because it was incredibly detailed in the sort of science of this guy's trapped on Mars. That's the whole book. It's Apollo 13 on Mars. It's like, I'd like to get off Mars, please. That's like the whole, that's the whole plot. So it was incredibly scientifically detailed, and it was also just like, you really wanted to know if this guy was going to get off Mars, and it didn't really matter that he didn't have any kind of like emotional insight into his situation because you really were into it.
Yeah.
So those two things I would say would be the unsellable.
You know? So it just in terms of like children's and YA, I probably can't sell wizard schools, vampires, or dystopian novels right now. Those are pretty much the three things that I almost immediately pass on because I think that I can't. Though, you know, maybe someone will write something really extraordinary in one of those and bring it back again. I don't know.
Yeah. Who knows? Who knows?
These things come in waves.
They do. I mean, everything comes in waves. His next question is about diversity, and I think that that needs like a, I think it needs its own episode.
Yeah. So, we're going to need to think about it because it's a very complicated, difficult question. And I would
other
like
than
to...
diversity is good.
Yes.
And we don't want to be glib in the sort of five yeah. minute question window. His last question is, speaking of success, are there stories that have received incredible acclaim, awards buzz, huge author blurbs that you just can't understand? I know it would be poor form to name names, but I was just wondering if this is strictly a reader phenomenon, or
nope.
Are there bestsellers on there that you wouldn't have championed? And the answer is yes.
Yes.
And the answer is we cannot talk about which ones we hate.
Well, I mean, I just talked about Twilight, as I would have passed on Twilight. It just does not work for me, and I went into it very open-minded, trying to see what my friend was recommending, and I was bored.
I think that, you know, I think it's also hard to talk about things that aren't currently working, because, like, things that are big now, especially since I'm, you know, in the industry, you know, even if I don't particularly like the book, I usually like the author, or I like the agent or the editor. So I don't want to just, like, shit on something that someone's worked really hard to do. But at the same time, I'm just like, really? That thing? Why?
I feel like with me saying I didn't like Twilight is kind of like throwing pebbles at a blimp. I'm probably it's not going to do any damage.
Yeah, she's fine. She's not going to be damaged.
Everyone's fine on that one.
You know, and there's always going to be books that like we don't connect with. I really wish that we had no qualms, but we have qualms and we cannot talk about it.
And it's, you know, there are very few people in this industry that I wish ill. Because we do like most of them. And so I don't, as Jen said, if it's, even if I don't like the book, I'm generally not.
And, you know, especially if it's something that's done well, that has, you know, sold a lot of copies and hit the times list, you know, a rising tide really does lift all boats.
True.
So, I really look forward to the day when we're not mentioning 50 Shades of Grey every fucking episode. But, you know, the year that that came out, Random House did so well they gave a $5,000 bonus to everyone in the company.
Every single employee.
The warehouse up.
Yeah.
So it wasn't just, you know, editors. It wasn't just, you know, publicity. It was everyone from the people who were, like, stocking the books to the very top. And I think that, you know, it's really easy to sort of be like, I really hated that book, which, you know, I kind of did. But, like, you know, it did a lot of good for the industry and for the company. Mm-hmm. And that gave them more money to sort of buy other stuff. So
that's the thing, is every single celebrity memoir or novel in air quotes that they don't actually write but that sells a lot of copies, and like Snooki's New York Times bestseller, as sad as that statement makes me,
I kind of find her endearing. I'm not gonna lie. I find her adorable.
And you know, the other thing is, I think it's very exciting and satisfying that people who are famous and rich for other things still want that badge of New York Times bestseller. They still want to write a book. They think that's something to be proud of.
That's still a brass ring that people are going for.
I think that's great. So
no, I agree. And I think that the other side of this is, you know, I think that, you know, the question could come up that, you know, because that's sort of what the industry is focused towards, you know, it sort of smaller books get ignored. Mm. And I think that there has never been, like, a halcyon time in which people were only in it for the prestige.
Yeah.
I mean, I could be wrong, but I feel like, you know.
I know.
Money has always been a thing that
people
in
publishing used to be able to afford summer houses, which is why we get Summer Fridays. But it's back when books were the primary entertainment, people would spend more money on them.
But I mean, there was a day when people saw the advent of like the Penguin 50 cent paperback as like the end times. That was the death knell for publishing.
And now we're like, great.
Paperbacks.
And you know, the books that sell really big allow publishers to spend money on the books that don't. It sort of subsidizes the smaller books.
Yeah, I concur.
Yeah.
Someday I would like to talk about the books that I hate, but
yes. Someday when we're big and fancy.
It's not that kind of podcast, unfortunately.
I think we'd have to be anonymous.
I really think we would.
Shit talk the podcast.
Your book sucks the podcast. Well, I mean, that's the other thing is like, you know, I've never written a book.
Yeah.
It's like,
neither have I.
You know, would I have sold something like that? I mean, it's the only time that I find it frustrating is when it's something that I've passed on.
Mm.
There's been a couple of projects that I've passed on and I'm just like,
But
why did I do that?
Or I'm like, but why do other people like that? What? I hated that so much. Why?
Well, not even that I hated it, just that it was sort of like, I could see that there were issues.
Yeah.
I usually, like, if I just absolutely hate something from the get-go, I just don't request it. So,
yes. Well, sometimes I get things that I think sound really interesting, and then I get to some point in the manuscript where I'm like, this is making me angry?
Yes.
Yes. In that case, I am not the right agent for it, and you don't want me as the agent. So, shall we talk about what we're reading right now?
Yes. What are you reading right now?
Actually, on your recommendation, I'm reading City of Stairs.
Oh, how are you enjoying it?
Well, I'm 30 pages in, but I like it so far. I started it last night.
Cool.
It is cool. It's exactly this. It's the human side of religion and the clash of cultures that I find really appealing and fascinating.
Colonialist narratives.
Yes.
I love it.
I find that it deals with real world things in a fantasy realm in a way that is not sort of a direct parallel. It's not an obvious sort of allegorical narrative. It just deals with the different sides of it and the way that people interact and the way cultures often can't understand the way the other, the people that they're interacting with can't, like, it just, it's like, but the way you do things makes no sense. It's like, it makes sense to them.
That's one of my favorite books from the last couple of years that I've read. Mm. I finished Discovery of Witches.
Okay.
I haven't yet decided if I'm going to read the second two.
Okay.
Because I had some issues with it. I mean, it was a fun read. I mean, if you didn't sort of think about it too hard, it was like a really fun read, and the characters are fun. But it did the thing for me where she just became the most special snowflake of all time, and for me, that was not as interesting as how I went into the book thinking about her.
Mm-hmm.
So that was sort of like, okay. But the next book is apparently taking place in the past, which I kind of love. So, I might check out the second one. But right now I'm reading, in addition to rereading the Dorothy L. Sayers books, I have been reading the Phryne Fisher. I've now read four.
Oh.
I've now read four of the Phryne Fisher books. They're charming and wonderful, and I love them deeply.
Excellent.
And speaking of sort of reading at night, I bought this book at Powell's last year when I went to Sirens, and I bought this, it's called Dreadnought, and it's about World War I. It's about the naval arms race between Germany and Great Britain. And it weighs so much that I can't actually, like, carry it around, because it's like this massive paperback. It's probably about 1,200 pages.
Oh, wow.
So I read that at night
before
I go to bed, because I feel good about, you know, reading some of it at night rather than, I mean, I can't schlep it on the subway. Like,
no,
it literally is the entire size of my purse.
And at that point, you kind of look like the person who's just trying to read this massive paperback on the subway to impress everyone.
I know, yeah. Whenever I see people, like
why are you carrying that?
It's like, you know, they make ebooks, right?
Or people with, like, the Game of Thrones hardcovers. I'm like, why?
Well, I could understand it when the last one came out, because it had just come out and people really wanted to read it. But at the same time, I'm like, you know that, like, 500 pages of that is feasts, right? Like, I could just tell you that right now.
Or sometimes you see people reading the library versions of that.
Yes.
Like, okay.
That's fair.
Stupid libraries buy paper.
True story. You and I are going to be attending a conference together.
Yes,
we are going to the Moravian Writers Conference in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. I believe that's in May.
No, it is Saturday, June 6th. We will be there.
And we will be on a panel with, I believe, Chuck Wendig.
Yes.
And someone else. And then...
we should have looked this up.
We should have looked this up before we started talking about it. But it's too late now. but we will be there if you are attending that conference.
Yes.
Are we also giving a workshop?
No, I think it's just the panel.
I think it's just the panel? Okay.
Yeah. It was also very cool because they invited us because they enjoyed our podcast.
So, yes. So, thank you very much for inviting us and for thinking of us.
Listen to us talk at each other in person.
Yeah. I will be attending the Pikes Peak Writers Conference in April and also the Emerald City RWA Conference in Seattle in October.
And I will be at the Atlanta Writers Conference in May.
Ooh, have fun.
Yeah.
Those guys are so nice.
Excellent. Yeah, they said that you recommended me. So thanks,
I did.
Jen.
I did recommend
you. That's very kind of you.
Because you're great. Alrighty. Well, I think that is all the time we have for today. Thank you again for listening. You can subscribe to us on iTunes. We're working on getting onto the Android service, which I was just informed was not part of the Libsyn package.
Okay.
But we're working on getting onto the Android podcast subscription. You can always ask us questions. You can subscribe to us on iTunes. Please leave us ratings, reviews, let us know how we're doing. You can also send feedback, questions, or things you would like us to discuss on the podcast to shippingandhandlingpodcast@gmail.com or via Twitter @shipandhandling or via our ask box on our website.
Yes.
But until next time, happy reading.
Yes, enjoy.
Bye.